This is the current federal tax developments for the week of August the 20th, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you, as always, by Kaplan Professional Education and by your State Society of CPAs. This week, the IRS stayed pretty quiet all week. What we're going to discover is that we've had some developments on the state level that are of use to us this week. We have a couple of IRS issues, one of which is a court case between the IRS and the AICPA. And then we have the AICPA gave some comments to the IRS on some outstanding issues that remain on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Oh, yeah, we still have a whole lot of issues there that we don't have answers for. And so we're all having a little bit of fun with that background. So with that, let's start out. And we spent a lot of time recently talking about sales tax issues with the state. But there are other taxes states impose and other taxes that your client could run into problems with when they are doing business, you know, with customers in that other state. And this week we had a case come down, Capital One Auto Finance, Inc. versus Department of Revenue, which is from the Supreme Court of the state of Oregon, docket number SCS064803, came down on August the 9th. This was a case of a corporation and the question of whether the corporation owed either the Oregon excise tax or the Oregon income tax. Now, we'll just accept, and I'll let you know, and if you want to dig into it, the court case tells you, but effectively those two taxes are the same thing. Actually, they're identical taxes. You pay one or the other. And there's a whole long discussion. The court even tells you why they have these two taxes in Oregon and actually why really they're probably not needed anymore to be two taxes, but just accept, because if you try to read the opinion pieces of it from time to time, you get confused because sometimes they're for the excise tax, sometimes they're for the income tax. But in any event, this represented some subsidiaries of Capital One, and these Capital One entities had no physical presence in the state of Oregon. They had no, basically, they didn't have any business in Oregon, you know, not any business in Oregon, but they didn't have any, you know, they didn't have an office there. And they also didn't have, in the state of Oregon, any employees there. So there weren't even employees in the state that were doing stuff. Now they did, however, you know, basically, they had their affiliates. They basically were offering credit cards and products, consumer loans, accepting deposits, engaging in consumer and small business lending from their offices outside of Oregon into the state of Oregon. Now, the company took the position that, hey, you know, we have no physical presence in the state. And so because of that, we can't possibly owe the Oregon income tax. However, they, you know, the Oregon Department of Revenue said, no, we're not so sure. And in the 2 years in question, these companies had sent 24 million solicitations to people in Oregon. They had 536,000 customers in 2007, fewer in 2008. And they charged nearly $150 million in fees during those years to residents of the state of Oregon. So the Oregon Department of Revenue wants their share of this. The taxpayers claimed that because they had no physical presence in the state of Oregon, they shouldn't be taxed. Now, they of course didn't say that they didn't have income from Oregon. They said, clearly we have income from Oregon and clearly we have customers in Oregon and that's income. So we're not saying we don't have income. We're not saying that it doesn't go to Oregon customers, but we're saying that we believe the statute that Oregon imposes the Oregon tax intentionally doesn't cover taxpayers who don't have a physical presence in the state of Oregon. And this is Oregon Revised Statutes 318.0201. Parenthesis one, kind of interesting there. What that tells is for who pays this tax is there's a tax on every corporation for each taxable year at a rate provided in this law upon its Oregon taxable income derived from sources within this state. Right. So basically, other than ones where it's subject to the other tax. Right. We told you we have two identical taxes here, so it's kind of weird. Now, you know, initially said, well, wait, you do have income from inside Oregon. And so are you arguing a constitutional issue? No, they're not. We'll talk about that toward the end here. But what they're saying is when the state legislature passed that section as part of 318.020 parenthesis 2, what they said was that, you know, income from within the state is property located there, income with a situs there, income from activities there. They said, look, all of these examples that we find in 318.020.2, you know, while they're not exclusive, every one of them has a business that is physically located in the state of Oregon. Therefore, we believe that the state of Oregon, being located in the state of Oregon, was what the legislature intended. Now, the court agreed that, you know, these examples are good for context, but they said, but, you know, they don't really suggest, you know, the examples, you know, are trying to look for the common characteristics that they think they're looking for. What they said, all the examples is that the income, the source of the income, is in the state of Oregon. In this case, the customer is paying the fees are in the state of Oregon. So for that reason, the court concludes that, in fact, you owe the income tax. You can't say I won't pay Oregon's income tax because I don't have a location in Oregon. Reality is you owe the Oregon income tax. So the bottom line was, of course, hey, you know, companies stuck with this problem. They owe the income tax. The law does not require physical presence. Now, this is of interest because this is an income tax case. You know, I've been so focused on sales tax, that's not the only exposure that your clients have or your business has. There's the exposure as well for income taxes or gross receipts taxes in the various states that are out there. Now, you know, did Wayfair change this? Arguably, it probably didn't. The courts were already leaning away from requiring any sort of physical presence for income taxes. Many of the court decisions in the years leading up to Wayfair had already kind of, you know, walled off Quill and treated Quill as a special case that only applied to sales taxes. Also to the point, you know, and so income taxes didn't necessarily have the same rule. But certainly Wayfair suggests that if there ever was a theory where physical presence would be required for income taxes, that seems to kind of have disappeared. One thing to remember about income taxes, you do have the protection of Public Law 86-272, but that is very narrow. Why didn't it apply in this case? It doesn't apply in this case because this outfit was selling services, not product. 86-272 only covers product. If you're covered by it, you can actually have salespeople in the state, but then there's a whole series of other things you have to, requirements you have to meet, and certain things you can't do in the state. I mean, your salespeople pretty much are required to be limited to sales activities or things that directly support sales activities, and you can't do anything like store any inventory in a state. In fact, you remember the Wrigley case. If you take a look at that case, which is really the key case in understanding 86-272, it is U.S. Supreme Court. Yeah, Wrigley Chewing Gum. That, you know, remember them? In that case, the mere fact that, in essence, salespeople who are visiting these locations, the stores that were selling Wrigley's gum, you know, the fact that they carried some supplies, you know, some gum. Gum for samples wasn't a problem, but they also carried gum. And if they found stale gum on the, you know, in the customer's shelves, they'd replace it. Or if they went to a customer who's about to run out of gum, they would basically give them that temporary stock. Supreme Court said, that's enough. You don't get 272 protection. So be careful. While you're looking at all these sales tax issues, consider income tax because, if, as you should have been aware, Wells Fargo took a just under $500 million hit to income in their last quarterly report. They did so because they think now that a lot of states are going to pursue some of their activities, maybe of subsidiaries that they thought weren't subject to that state's tax that now are. So be careful. This also is an issue. Make sure you keep your eyes open because I think Wells may be right. The states are likely to get more active. Well, don't forget about sales taxes because, hey, we had development in that this week. This is a news release from the Idaho State Tax Commission. This news release came out on August the 15th. And this news release talks about Idaho, who had, we kind of discussed previously, they had adopted an out-of-state seller law that was tied heavily to whether you had an arrangement with a retailer in the state of Idaho. And if you had that, then if you had more than a minimal amount of sales, you had to collect sales taxes. And your arrangement was not that you gave inventory to somebody in Idaho, but that you had an Idaho retailer who would refer to you, like on their website, or has an affiliate. And by the way, retailer appears to be defined very broadly. So you essentially have an Idaho resident who puts a link on their website, you know, kind of like those affiliate links from things like Amazon, that somebody goes to their website, they click on that link, they buy the widget from your client. Your client pays a commission to the Idaho entity that had this link on their website. That suddenly causes you an issue. The Idaho State Tax Commission, give the right name, they sent out letters to 500 retailers this week. Those are 500 retailers, presumably from out of state, who presumably aren't currently collecting Idaho sales tax, kind of telling them, hey, guys, you know what? You got to start collecting this stuff. And we're going to be kind of knocking on the door to make sure you do it. Under this rule, you must collect Idaho sales tax if you have an arrangement with an Idaho retailer where they get paid a commission when somebody like clicks through on their site and buys your product. So basically click through Nexus, any other sort of commission issue where an Idaho retailer refers out to you, and you have more than $10,000 worth of sales to Idaho residents. Note, that is way below the South Dakota limit of $100,000 for economic nexus. Now, the interesting part about this is this was designed, in Idaho's view, to be able to clear and be okay under the Quill standard. Idaho's theory is that retailer in Idaho is an agent acting for you. And as an agent acting for you, that retailer in Idaho is collecting, is basically giving you physical presence in Idaho. Since you have physical presence, they can force you to collect. As you're probably aware, you know, those of us here like in Arizona, if I'm a very small business in Arizona, you know, and I sell $10,000 worth of product, yes, I've got to collect Arizona Standard Transaction Privilege Tax and remit it, you know, as long as it's not a casual sale. So bottom line, yeah, they're saying you've got physical presence, so we're going after you. Will that stand scrutiny post Wayfair? Not totally sure, because again, the U.S. Supreme Court, while saying you didn't need physical presence, also seems skeptical that a minor physical presence, I think we can all agree, the presence we're talking about here with the Idaho retailer can be extraordinarily minor, that that's not enough to necessarily make sense to force somebody to collect. The due process issue could come up. The Idaho State Tax Commission also said they're studying the Wayfair decision. There's a separate Idaho provision that's going to allow the state of Idaho to force collection of sales tax under the rules that essentially are allowed by Wayfair, you know, or based on this. That may mean that they are considering whether they need to jump that 10 grand to 100 grand and 200 transactions or not. This will be interesting, but right now they're moving on the 10 grand issue. So I would start assuming that you better start getting ready if you're selling into the state of Idaho and you sell virtually anything into the state of Idaho. You better get ready to start collecting the sales tax. If you have any sort of program where you pay commissions to people that give affiliates, recommend your product, if you do any of that, you got to be ready to basically file with the state of Idaho, collect the sales tax. You know, it's got to be a really great year for Avalara. Avalara or the others, TaxJar, the people that handle this sort of, the sales tax people who are now integrating with systems, it's got to be a really good year for them. Next up, we have the AICPA, who is suing the IRS. AICPA versus IRS, case number 16-5256, this is from the DC Court of Appeals. I love that. I've got an abbreviation in the materials that you might read as District Court of California. It's actually the DC Court of Appeals. So understand, DCCA, I should have said CADC, but okay, whatever. The opinion came down on August the 14th. Now, here's the catch. The AICPA had gone to court in the District of Columbia, suing the IRS, claiming they had no authority to set up their credentialed tax preparer program. You may remember that was one of the things that came out of after the IRS got knocked down the Loving decision, where they couldn't force everybody to be registered. They came up with this program that allows a non-enrolled individual. By the way, non-enrolled individual means somebody who is not a CPA, enrolled agent, or an attorney. An unenrolled individual to take this exam, be given the certificate from the IRS that's good for a year, have their name put on the IRS website as a tax preparer, and then also be able to do the very limited amount of representation that used to be what unenrolled preparers generally were allowed to do. Now, unenrolled preparers are not allowed to do any of that sort of very limited representation, but these guys who passed this are allowed to do so. The AICPA sued, claiming that the IRS had no authority to do this, and secondly, that it put CPAs at an unfair disadvantage. Now, the actual district court in DC dismissed the AICPA's case, claiming that the AICPA had no standing to sue. Well, good news for the AICPA on the appeal. the Court of Appeals ruled that they did have standing. But in what's somewhat unusual, I mean, but it makes sense when you understand the point here. Normally, what would happen if the district court said you have no standing to sue, the Court of Appeals says, no, you got it wrong. They have standing. Normally the Court of Appeals would kick it back to the district court for the trial. But in this case, the entire case was a case of law. Everything had been briefed out. There was actually no real major facts in play here. So what the DC Circuit said was, we can just decide this right now, because what's going to happen is it's going to go to district court. We know whoever loses is going to appeal to us, and we would decide it, you know, de novo anyway. So we'd start over. So we're just going to decide it now. And what they decided was, A, the IRS clearly has the authority to do this. The AICPA claimed that the authority wasn't there. They tried to use the Loving decision, which I always thought was a little bit tough, because the Loving decision actually invited the IRS to do something like this. So not surprised that they held that the Loving decision didn't block this. And then the AICPA said, but we told the IRS about these, we told the IRS, you know, that we thought they had alternatives, and they didn't consider those alternatives. So they acted arbitrarily and capriciously. The district court ruled in this case that they acted neither way. They said all the AICPA said was, oh, there's the alternatives, but they didn't mention any that could actually work. So because of this, this program for registered tax return preparers is actually going to be up and running. You know, well, it's already is up and running. It's going to continue. The AICPA challenge died with this. I'm going to assume there's a high probability, A, the AICPA won't even bother trying to appeal this to the U.S. Supreme Court. And secondly, if they did, the U.S. Supreme Court would almost certainly decide they don't want to hear the case. So I think we're basically done with this. So yes, credentialed preparer program from the IRS will continue to operate. And, you know, like it or not, AICPA, you know, took their shot, and the court decided it didn't work. Well, let's go for something that works a little bit better for us from the AICPA standpoint. This is an AICPA letter to the IRS. This letter was issued on August the 13th of this, August 13th, right? It's a letter from the AICPA tax section to the IRS and Treasury regarding, you know, upcoming guidance that needs to be issued on S corporations and the issue of the excess business loss on Section 461L. Now, the AICPA has a 3-page letter and a 16-page memorandum that outlines things that they need to be clarified. Basically all kinds of issues here. In addition to, we'll talk about 461L separately here in just a second. But they said, look, you need to coordinate the loss deductions that apply to an S-Corp. Like, you know, what about 199 cap A, and how is that impacted by, you know, the limitation on interest deductions on 163J? The basis limitation of 1366D. How about the at-risk rules of 465? The passive activity rules of 469? How about that excess loss rule 4617? In essence, what's the ordering rule for testing these things? How do we go through doing it? Some clarifications on that interest carryover rule. If you have excess business interest, that it does apply to S corporations. Clarify the definition of real property trade or business. And that's also for disallowed interest. By the way, that also goes outside of this S-Corp only. And, you know, some other issues. They also want to know some issues regarding the post-termination transition period and the eligible terminated S-Corporation period. Remember, we have 2 years to go from S to C and our AAA. If we don't go our AAA out during the 1 year afterward, we can still do it proportionally in the future. You want to know how that works. And the AICPA said, you know, people are trying to make up their minds right now. Should they blow their S election? Should they go back to C? And they're saying, we can't really make that decision unless we know how these things are going to work. So IRS, can you actually tell us something about these issues? Right? So we raise a number of the S Corp issues. Now, what is also interesting, though, which I think is significant, is the AICPA also raises an issue that, I mean, it affects S-Corps because S-Corps can have losses, but it really affects far more than S-Corp. And they have a question about the 461L carryover. For those of you that don't speak in code section, 461L is the provision that says if you have excess business losses in a year as an individual, Those excess losses are more than $250,000 net business loss, or more than $500,000 if it's a married couple filing joint return. The excess, the amount of your loss in excess of that $250,000 is disallowed, and then it's treated in the following year as a net operating loss carryover. Here's the catch that we're trying to figure out. Let's say we have a $2 million loss, net loss. I mean, we lost big. So I'm filing married, filing joint. So I take $500,000 and I have a $1.5 million loss carryover the next year. And let's assume the next year we break even in our business operations during the year. Question. Does the $1.5 million now again come into the calculation? So I can't use the whole $1.5 million of the NOL. I can only use a $500,000 of it because it's again going to be blocked by 461L. The AICPA is urging, and they give you the reasons why if you want to read the memorandum, and it's in our material this week, you know, their outline of this. They're saying that really shouldn't happen. They're saying the way the code says this becomes an NOL. If it becomes an NOL, it should no longer be a 461L business loss, and rather it should be subject to the rules that are involved for NOLs only, the 90% rule, and that's it. How that's get resolved could be interesting. I mean, hopefully the AICPA position is sustained. I think it makes the most sense under the law. But then again, making sense and sometimes how things get interpreted, not quite sure. Now, good news, right? The AICPA says we want this immediately. Unfortunately, as you know, as Mick Jagger said, you can't always get what you want. And you may remember that the AICPA has very early in the year went out and said, you know, we need guidance immediately on 199 Cap A. That was at the end of February. We finally got our first guidance on the beginning of August. That doesn't really seem to be my test immediately. They also told us the 1st of April that we needed immediately guidance on the meals and entertainment, which we have heard nothing about to today. So do I think that because of this letter next week, the IRS is going to issue a notice that tells us how all this stuff's going to be resolved? I wouldn't bet on it. There's a large backlog of IRS guidance on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And a lot of those letters, of course, arrived before this letter. So my gut is no, we're not going to get there. And rather, this is just going to go in. And I mean, it's good. You might as well ask to do it quickly. You know you're probably not going to get it, but you ask for it. Why not ask? But it will almost certainly go into the considerations that the IRS will enter into and actually issue guidance. If you read, by the way, you all have read the 199 Cap A regs now, right? You all went and did that. If you read the preamble there, you notice that the IRS quite often talks about, you know, comments, suggestions, thing they received before they issued those regs. So that's going to, you know, we're going to assume they're going to continue to do that. And so because of that, you know, we're going to be hopeful that the recommendations found in here will at least be paid some attention to by the IRS as we move forward. Well, hey, wanted to remind you, we've still got those 199 Cap A sessions coming up. We do a couple of them here. Got two coming up here in the very near future. One's coming up very quickly. In fact, if you're listening to this on Thursday, you missed it. But on Wednesday, August the 22nd, for the Arizona Society of CPAs, I'm going to be presenting a four-hour session on 199 Cap A, what we've learned and what we haven't learned from the proposed regs. It will start at noon Mountain Standard Time. Now, I said Mountain Standard Time. That was not a mistake. Arizona does not go on Daylight Savings Time. So, yes, it's MST. So for most of the rest of the world, you might think that's Pacific Time. Okay, but that's how we'll do it. The live session will be at their offices in Phoenix on 4801 East Washington. Also, please note, normally four-hour courses in the afternoon when I do the Arizona tax update after doing the ethics in the morning, we start at 12:30. When they do a pair of four hours, they start the second one at 12:30. Because there is no morning session on this one, it's going to start at noon, so we end at the 3:30 time. We normally end that for the regular eight-hour sessions. But just remember that you need to be down there a half hour early, half hour earlier than you would be if you've ever come down there just for an afternoon session. And if you're tuning in on the web, because there is a web version of this too, you can listen to it from the comfort of your home. The webcast will start at noon as well. Okay, that'll be there. Have quite a few people signed up already, so it's actually a pretty good thing. If you haven't signed up and you want to, the Arizona Society website can sign you up. Again, ascpa.com. Go to the CPE and you go for this week's CPE and you'll find this, at least if this week, for this week, you're going in there before August the 22nd. If you go in after that date, well, yeah, it won't be there. Also then the following week on the 30th, I'll be doing a webinar for the Idaho Society of CPAs. It will be the same material, same course. It will start at 9 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time. Notice the difference there, daylight versus standard. Or 8 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time, which, of course, Pacific Daylight Time is Mountain Standard. So that's my time, but, you know, don't worry about that. We got both times here because, as those of you in Idaho know, there are portions of Idaho in the Pacific time zone, portions are in the Mountain time zone. Whichever one you're in, you know, show up at the right time is really the catch. It is, as I said, a webcast event only. It'll be handled through Adobe Connect. So, you know, make sure you're okay working with Adobe Connect. As always, if you've not done Adobe Connect before, actually, if you've not done the AICPA one, I should say Arizona Society CPA one before, then you probably also have this issue. You're going to get some permissions in your browser these days to get through. You'll want to use a few things. Just give them and you're fine. For the Idaho session on the 30th, you can register there at idcpa.org, Idaho Society website. Again, look for the CPE, and you're going to look for the CPE on the 30th. It will be a webinar, and you can sign up for it there. Both of these are four-hour courses, and we're going to talk about a lot of neat things in here. This week, I gave courses on, one of my courses was on assisting survivors at seed in the state, and one of the real interesting things that we discussed there is, and you might want to go look at this, you work with the states and trust, is how the QBI rules are going to work with a trust or estate. So if Harry dies, Harry had a Schedule C business. You know, Harry's son's an employee of the business. Harry's son's the personal rep. So Harry's son now comes in. He's running that business through the estate for a while. That's going to be a material participation activity. And oh, by the way, maybe the business doesn't do so well because Harry died. So there's a loss. The IRS has an example that goes through that. And it may surprise you what happens in that situation. I'll put it this way. If I change the facts of the example just a little bit, a $1,000 distribution to an heir during the year from the estate could end up carrying out a over $20,000 reduction in QBI for that individual. And assuming that they have business income of their own, could end up reducing their deduction. So it's interesting. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the incredible, amazing, disappearing unadjusted basis that happens whenever you go through a 1031 exchange or when you may be incorporated an entity. We'll talk about all the other neat things like what's a specified service business and how what we got there and what's a trader business and are rentals trader businesses and or when are they trader businesses? All those neat things coming up. We're going to talk about that in our seminar. Again, as I say, we couldn't be doing this and wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for what we do through the state societies. Make sure you consider signing up now for state society courses. Again, most state societies are going to have some courses on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. You know, consider signing up there. By the way, if you want, we're perfectly willing to do these sessions for firms. You know, if you have enough, obviously, if you're a solo practitioner, yeah, you could pay for us to come in, but the math might not work out so well. But if you're going to have enough people and you need a lot of people trained on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in general or on 199 Cap A, you can contact your state society or contact Kaplan directly. And we can arrange to have, somebody come out and teach the section on that. If I'm available, I can come out and teach the section. We have the other instructors for Kaplan also can come out and help teach sessions on these issues. So if you're looking at that for this year, go ahead and sign up. One key caveat, gets really busy for us from October 15th to December 15th. So if you're looking for a date in there, it's going to be a little fun finding it. But if you have flexibility and your firm's willing to talk to us about doing something in January, it gets a little bit easier to fit people in. So just fair warning. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for this week. Be sure you catch our regular updates online, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We'll update you there. We'll talk to you about we can tell you about things as happened. They happened during the week. This week was very quiet. So we don't have a lot federal there, but we do have the state stuff. You can send questions or comments to me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Ed Zollers. You can send me a direct message. You can send a message via there. Getting involved in a few discussions there from time to time. Also, you can follow my discussions on the subreddit of reddit.com/rtaxpros. I also pay some attention to the discussion groups of California Tax Talk, Arizona Society of CPAs Connect discussion group, and the New Jersey Society of CPAs Connect discussion group. So if you're a member of one of those, if you're a member of Arizona or New Jersey, or you're a CPA anywhere in the country who signs up for Tax Talk, you can post questions, discussions there. Those are great places, even if, doesn't matter whether I'm responding or not. There's always lots of good discussion going there and lots of good resources for CPAs. Well, we got through this week without a whole bunch of IRS guidance for the first time in a long time. And that's actually not a bad thing. So hopefully we'll have another calm week, so I have enough time to digest this 199 guidance. And we'll see you next week, though, whatever happens, on current federal tax developments for next week.